Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlohm. At the time of recording this program, it's spring here in my home in Northern California, and that means lots of interesting visitors to my backyard bird feeders. From migrating hummingbirds to hawks and songbirds, there's a lot going on in the morning dawn chorus when I wake up to the sound of birdsong. While I'm not an avid birder, I do love the avian species that I see wherever I am outdoors, which is why I'm delighted to be joined by our guest. Scott Weidensahl is an expert on birds and bird migration in particular. He's the author of more than 30 books, including the Pulitzer Prize finalist Living on the Wind and the New York Times bestseller A World on the Wing. In Weidensahl's latest book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher, the Pennsylvania native and New Hampshire resident examines some truly inspiring and moving bird conservation stories from around the world. He joins us now. Scott Weidensahl, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Dave. I've been looking forward to this.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed this book, and we'll get into it in a bit. But first, your love of nature and the outdoors and birds in particular is something that really fascinates me. So I'm most interested to find out how people get connected to that world. Tell us about how you grew up and how nature was such an important part of your life, and then how birds became a part of your life.
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, I can't remember a time when nature and birds weren't part of my life. You know, my mother joked I sort of came out of the womb with a pair of binoculars, which I don't really quite believe. But literally, birders often talk about their spark bird, you know, the bird that got them interested in birds and birding. I don't have a spark bird. It's just always been there. When I was younger, you know, like through high school, I was probably more serious about herps, reptiles and amphibians, especially snakes. I loved snakes. I still love snakes. I got hooked on hawk watching when I was about 12 years old at a place called Hawk Mountain Sanctuary in eastern Pennsylvania, which was the world's first sanctuary for birds of prey.
Yeah, Scott, could you tell us about that story? Because that's really cool. For people on the West Coast don't know about Hawk Mountain. I know a little bit about it. But tell us about what a special place that was and that experience you had as a 12-year-old that really, you know, shaped your love of raptors in particular.
Sure. So Hawk Mountain is it's something called the Kittatinny Ridge, which is sort of the front range of the Appalachian Ridge and Valley system. So that long system of parallel ridges and valleys that runs from sort of northeast to southwest across out of New York and across Pennsylvania and down into Maryland. And in the fall, tens of thousands of hawks, eagles, falcons, and vultures, as they're moving south with their migration, kind of riding this ridge, riding the deflection currents of, you know, northwesterly winds blowing and hitting this long line of ridges, and they sort of, you know, the winds kind of billow up, and these birds are basically surfing their way south on wind currents. And it's an extraordinary migration. But the problem is, in the early 20th century, when the only good hawk was a dead hawk, people gathered by the hundreds on fall afternoons to shoot these birds as they were going by. And it was this absolute slaughter. I mean, thousands and thousands of dead raptors every year. And this was at a time when even conservationists, even ornithologists, tended to divide birds between good birds and bad birds. And good birds were the birds that sing pretty songs and eat injurious insect pests and, you know, like songbirds and things like that. And the bad birds were the birds that ate the good birds. And so hawks were kind of bad birds. Raptors were bad birds. And so this slaughter was going on year after year after year. And there were people that were trying to stop it. There was a guy named Richard Poe, who was a photographer and nature enthusiast from the Philadelphia area. And he sort of stumbled on this charnel house on this ridgetop where, you know, so many birds were being shot in a weekend that, you know, scrap merchants were showing up and like shoveling up hundreds and hundreds of shotgun shells to, you know, to recycle for their brass bases. And Poe and his friends spent this, I have to think, rather gruesome weekend lining up hundreds and hundreds of dead hawks and eagles and falcons on the ground and taking pictures of them and then trying to get somebody to do something about this. And he went to the Audubon Society, and they were, you know, the National Association of Audubon Societies was concerned, and they hemmed and hawed a bit, but they weren't really going to do anything about it. I mean, he got so desperate at one point, he went to the National Sabbath Day Foundation and said, look, they're shooting these birds on Sunday. That's got to be a sin. And then he finally went to a woman named Rosalie Edge, who was one of the largely, until recently, largely unsung heroes of American conservation. She had been active in the suffrage movement. She had a deeply unhappy marriage, and she had taken solace in birdwatching in the 1920s and 1930s. And she'd started something called the Emergency Conservation Committee, which took a pretty activist approach to wildlife conservation. And when Mrs. Edge, and it was always Mrs. Edge, found out about this, she made the decision to simply buy the mountaintop where the shooting was taking place. It was up for sale for back taxes. And so she, even though she really didn't have the money for it, she took out a lease with an option to buy, and she did it on the day that a local gun club was voting to buy the mountain to keep it open for hawk shooting. That's how close run this whole thing was.
Wow.
And that was the genesis of Hawk Mountain Sanctuary. It was and remains a privately owned wildlife sanctuary. It's about a little more than 2,000 acres today, north of Reading, Pennsylvania, on the Kittatinny Ridge. I got hooked on raptors as a 12-year-old at Hawk Mountain, the very first time my parents took me up there, more than 50 years ago. The notion of these birds pouring down the ridges of the Appalachians, coming from as far away as the Canadian Arctic or Greenland, and heading in some cases, like peregrine falcons, as far south as southern South America, just was an absolutely riveting thing. And my very first visit up there, I had this sharp-shinned hawk that sort of dove down. It looked like it was diving straight toward me. It was actually coming down to attack an owl decoy that was up on a post above my head. And I got riveted by birds of prey that day, and that hasn't let me go.
Well, that notion of bad birds, I mean, there's even people I know that are like, they don't like blue jays because they eat baby birds out of nests or whatever.
Yeah.
And I love the blue jays in my yard. I think they're wonderful and they're so smart. I can tell that they know who I am because they, you know, they're very comfortable around me. They'll hop around and they're just fun to watch. And my notion after listening to what you said is there are no bad birds, but there are badass birds. And those are those raptors.
That's right. Well, and what happened at Hawk Mountain, that was, you know, that was the first place in the world that birds of prey were protected. And also the first place in the world where anybody decided to do an annual migration count to start tallying how many of these birds were passing by. Mrs. Edge hired a young Romanian immigrant, a young ornithologist named Maurice Bruin, to be the first warden. His job was to keep the gunners off the mountain, but he also was required to be up on the lookout every day counting the hawks that were going by. And so he had his not quite 5-foot-tall wife, Irma, they were newlyweds, they'd just been married. She was the one down at the bottom of the trail telling the guys with the guns, no, you can't go up there. You're welcome to go up if you leave the gun down here. And that was possibly the smartest thing that he ever did, because these were rough Pennsylvania German farmers, rough Pennsylvania coal miners. If it had been Bruin down there, I suspect he would have ended up being shot. But these were men, as rough as they were, who had an instinctive respect for women. And they grumbled, but they either left their guns and walked up without the guns, or they turned around and left. And Hawk Mountain has, in the more than 90 years since then, that notion of raptor conservation has spread around the world. And there are hundreds of places across North America, including many on the West Coast, up at the Marin Headlands, on the north side of the Golden Gate, where people conduct standardized hawk counts today as a way of monitoring raptor populations. And all of that started 90 some years ago at Hawk Mountain. It's a remarkable legacy of global raptor conservation.
That is really amazing. And I never really thought about or realized that raptors migrate like so many migratory birds, because I've never really noticed that where I live. Does migration like that with raptors happen analogously here on the West Coast as what you observe there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, in fact, some of the Western raptors are some of the most long distance raptor migrants in the world. Swainson's hawks, for example, you know, breeding in Northern California. So they spend the winter in Argentina. They're traveling like 18,000 miles a year. And many of them, especially those from the West, but many of the raptor migrants from the East, the long distance migrants like broad-winged hawks that move down into South America for the winter, something like 4.5 million of them every year pass through this little narrow gap between the Gulf of Mexico and the mountains of central Mexico through Veracruz State. And it is an extraordinary thing to see, to sit on a rooftop in a town like Chichicoxtli in Veracruz and watch like 70,000 broad-winged hawks or Swainson's hawks in a single gigantic boiling mass as they're passing through. It's not unusual down there for folks to count more than 1 million raptors in a single day at the peak of the migration. So yeah, I mean, these are globe-girdling migrations that these birds are undergoing. And, you know, to kind of bring this back to history here, raptors are one of the groups of birds that in the last half century we've been able to recover. Birds, I mean, I graduated from high school in 1976, and at that time, bald eagles were virtually gone in the lower 48.
Yes.
There were like 1,000, there were fewer than 1,000 individual bald eagles in the lower 48. If you had told me that when we were, you know, that was the bicentennial year, 1976, if you told me that when we were celebrating the 250th anniversary of the country, what the Cesco, whatever the heck it is, I can never keep that, remember that word, that there would be 400,000 bald eagles in the lower 48, I would have thought you were delusional. Peregrine falcons were completely gone from the East. They were extinct as a breeding species in Eastern North America. And they're, you know, bald eagles are off the endangered species list. Peregrine falcons are off the endangered species list. We've seen dramatic recoveries of many other species of raptors. Part of what I'm writing about in this new book is that we can save birds. We know how to do this. You know, the news for birds has been grim for a long time. We keep hearing, you know, new reports constantly about declining bird populations, but all around the world, people are figuring out ways to save birds. You know, we've done it with raptors. I've seen it within my own lifetime. It's been an extraordinary thing.
Well, me too. I would say I graduated in 77, and I can recall the same kind of thing.
Yep.
And then, you know, now I live in Northern California here in 2026. And just this morning, you know, I saw a bald eagle flying over my yard because I live near the Sacramento River. Mm-hmm. And it's so not unusual. I'm always excited to see them. But it's like, it's just, they are pretty common around here now. Yeah. We all love them. And it is a wonderful story. Do we have Rachel Carson really to thank for that and the eradication of DDT?
We do. Although part of it also was just we have to understand that by the time the bottom fell out for raptors during the DDT era, that culminated 200 years of raptor persecution, where anybody with a gun who saw a bird of prey shot it, because it was the civically responsible thing to do. Everybody knew these birds were bad, that they ate your chickens, and if you were a hunter, they were competing with you for pheasants or grouse or rabbits or whatever it was you hunted. And so, you know, people, like I said, even conservationists didn't think that much about it. So, you know, we really hit this nadir in the 1960s and early 70s. And then you had organochloride pesticides like DDT and that whole family of, you know, highly persistent, highly toxic, bioaccumulating pesticides that work their way up through food chains. And it wasn't just raptors. I mean, it was double-crested cormorants and brown pelicans. I mean, brown pelicans were virtually gone from California. They were virtually gone from the Gulf Coast. Many of the smaller raptors, like Cooper's hawks, that just pretty much disappeared under the radar that nobody really noticed. And so along with the banning of DDT, and, you know, I can remember when I was in middle school, you know, around the time when the environmental movement was really getting going, and, you know, ban DDT was one of the big slogans. I remember reading this passionate essay to my eighth grade class about why we had to, you know, ban DDT and, you know, save the birds. And, you know, like my classmates were like, oh my God, that Weidensall nut is going off about birds again. But, you know, but it worked. And so, and it happened also at a time when legal protection for birds of prey was coming in. You know, it took through the 50s and 60s and early 70s before federal protection was granted to all birds of prey. And so, you know, if you stop poisoning them and you stop shooting them, they actually respond pretty well. They'll come back. Who'd have thunk it?
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation about bird conservation success stories around the world with Scott Wiedensahl. He's the author of the new book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with Scott Wiedensahl. Scott is the author of nearly 30 books, mostly about birds and bird migration, and we're discussing his newest work focusing on conservation success stories. Its title is The Return of the Oyster Catcher. Could you just briefly talk about how you've taken your passion for nature and birds in particular and turned it into, you know, a lifelong pursuit that's, you know, been able to keep a roof over your head, as it were?
Well, I'm not sure that there's a brief way of saying it, because I've had such a weirdly circuitous route. I mean, I mentioned that I was interested in herps when I was a kid. When I went to college, I decided I wanted to be a professional herpetologist and study snakes. The problem is, you have to be able to do math for a college biology degree, and I can't do math to save my life. I mean, if I were growing up today, I'd be diagnosed with a learning disability, a pretty severe one when it comes to math. So I thought, okay, well, you know, I always liked art. I'll be a wildlife artist. So I, you know, the state university I was going to had a really good art department. I switched majors. I became an art major. Yeah, you know, trying to do representational wildlife art in the 1970s when the rage in the art world was abstract expressionism, not a real smart career move. And I had increasing friction with my advisor in the art department over my desire to take as many natural history and science courses as I could. And the friction finally got to the point where I dropped out the beginning of my junior year, and I never went back and finished my degree. I never got a degree in anything aside from a high school diploma. Now, I have two honorary doctorates, one of them from the university I dropped out of. So I think maybe things are all forgiven. But I ended up spending 10 years as a newspaper reporter at a small family-owned newspaper in eastern Pennsylvania that at the time was one of the best small newspapers in the country. I got that job because I started writing and illustrating a weekly natural history column for them. I learned to write there. I had no training as a journalist. I had no training as a writer. At the time, I was doing more and more work with raptors. I was doing raptor rehabilitation, working with injured birds of prey. I actually had the necessary federal and state permits to possess non-releasable birds of prey that, as part of my newspaper job, I was taking into classrooms and doing raptor education. On the side, I was doing a lot of freelance writing about natural history. And finally, like about 40 years ago, I jumped ship and started freelancing full-time as a natural history writer. Dave, it's been a wild ride, I got to tell you. It's been completely unpredictable. I have been the beneficiary of some really good luck over the years. But yeah, I get to travel the world now writing about natural history, and especially birds and bird migration. And over the last 25 or 30 years, I've gotten more and more directly involved in migration research, working with, you know, amazing scientists who've become good friends and colleagues who don't look down their nose at me because I don't have a college degree like they do. I don't have a PhD except for the honorary ones. But it's been great. I've been able to do work in places like Denali National Park in Alaska with the National Park Service, and the coast of Maine and the coast of Alabama in the springtime, banding birds as they're flying north on their spring migration, getting involved with tracking snowy owls, working with what's turned into one of the largest snowy owl research projects in the world, something called Project Snowstorm that a bunch of us started kind of at blind abandon about 12 years ago to learn more about snowy owls during one of the biggest snowy owl invasions on record. It's been wild. It's been great. I love it. I was mistakenly referred to as a retired journalist in a newspaper article recently. I'm like, retired? I have no intention of retiring. I'm having too much fun.
Absolutely. And, you know, I will say that your calling to the birds has just been absolutely serendipitous for them, you and us, your readers. Your previous book to this one, A World on the Wing, mm-hmm. just such a beautiful account of migratory birds and their epic journeys. You know, you talked about the journeys of the hawks earlier, and it just astounds me to think of, especially like hummingbirds, that travel thousands of miles. It's just amazing. Oh. And I'm wondering, you know, you had that experience. What was it that led you to want to write this book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher?
So I have to, first off, I have to say the idea for this book was given to me by a good friend. After A World on the Wing came out, a good friend of mine, a fellow named Charles Duncan, who spent years in the trenches, particularly on shorebird conservation, Charles and I were teaching a summer course on the coast of Maine at National Audubon's Hog Island camp. And he said, okay, you've written this book about all the challenges facing migratory birds around the world. He said, why don't you do a book about what's actually going right for bird conservation? Because he said, there's good news out there and people need to hear it. And I thought, that is actually a brilliant idea. And so I spent, you know, the last 3.5 years looking at bird conservation success stories around the world. And I mean, I have to admit that about a year ago, when I finished this book and turned it into my editor, at a time when we had a new administration coming in that was very obviously declaring war on science and conservation and the environment, it seemed like, oh my God, this is like the worst possible timing. This is nuts. Now, with another year or so under our belt, I think maybe this is the best time for a book like this. I think all of us who are involved in conservation need a dose of optimism. We need a little bit of good news. And the thing is, all around the world, there is good news for birds. And you know, one of the points I make in this book is, why should we care about birds? Because a world that works for birds will work for everything, including us. If we can figure out a way to have a planet that is sustainable for 11,000 species of birds covering moving across the world in these extraordinarily complex migrations that are dependent on a sustained web of functioning ecosystems. If it works for them, it'll work for us. You know, we get to come along for the ride. And against often really severe odds, people are turning the dial in the right direction for bird conservation. I think we're in for a rough ride here in the United States, but there's a whole big world out there. But even in the United States, people are doing the right thing. And in some cases, seeing their lives transformed by birds. I mean, one of the people I write about is a rancher in southeastern Colorado, a fellow named Russell Davis.
Yes, I'd love this story.
Yeah,
go ahead.
So Russell would have described himself as a rock-ribbed, deep-red, large-sea conservative rancher, the plains of southeastern Colorado, the Colorado desert. And Russell was out on his ranch one day in 2001, and you know, he saw a vehicle off in the distance in one of his pastures. He was out looking in the springtime looking for newborn calves. And he assumed it was one of his neighbors, but when he got closer, he realized it was a Toyota truck, and nobody in ranch country drives a Toyota, God forbid. And it was a young woman with a big floppy hat and binoculars around her neck and a pair of shorts.
And the last kind of person he wanted to see.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, look, ranchers can, I know a lot of folks out west, and hospitality is baked into them, but the one thing that they just do not abide is trespass. And he, you know, so he comes boiling up. And before he can say anything, she says, "Mr. Davis, they're everywhere." Well, they were standing in the middle of a prairie dog town.
And he thought she was talking about the prairie dogs, right?
She's like, yeah, of course, we're in a prairie dog town. They're everywhere. She said, no. They're mountain plovers. There's mountain plovers everywhere. Now, he had no idea what a mountain plover was. He said, whatever this mountain thing is, they're 70 miles from the Rockies. This thing's lost. And she went on to explain that mountain plovers are one of the rarest shorebirds in North America. And the Weininger Davis Ranch, his family's ranch, had kind of the mother load of mountain plovers, which was not the best news, because she also explained that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was considering listing these things on the federal endangered species list. Well, if there's anything...
Not what they want to hear.
Yeah, if there's anything a rancher hates more than prairie dogs, it's the federal government coming in and telling them you got an endangered species on their property. Well, he throws this young woman off his property. He's like, you know, I don't want to hear anymore. You get out. But that was the start of an extraordinary journey that Russell and his family made.
And it wasn't easy. One of my favorite parts of that story in your book is, you know, the local paper, you know, puts in there, it's because you can explain this to us why the prairie dog population is important for the plovers. But the local paper says, oh, this guy's, you know, saving 500 acres of prairie dogs. And, you know, that does not go down well with those ranchers.
Oh, no, absolutely not. They were putting a conservation easement on the ranch, which would have provided a significant amount of money at a time when they desperately needed it. They were going bankrupt from the result of a multi-year drought, and it seemed like they were going to lose a big part of the ranch. But by putting the ranch under conservation easement, which meant it could never be developed and would always remain a cow-calf operation, so it would remain in ranching in perpetuity, it would save the ranch. It would protect the prairie, the habitat that these rare mountain plovers need. This is a shorebird that doesn't like the shore. It's a bare earth plover would be a better name for it. And they love prairie dog towns.
Why is that habitat so good for the plovers?
They like to be able to nest in the ground, on the ground, where they can see if there are predators coming. They also like agricultural fields, like freshly plowed agricultural fields as well. They're just attracted to that bare ground. They're attracted to places where there's very sparse vegetation. This is a bird of these high arid plains, and that's where they breed in the summertime in Colorado all the way up into southern Canada. That's where they winter in places like southern California and northern Mexico. And there's less and less of that habitat out there. Their populations have been dropping. And it took a lot of convincing for conservation groups like the Bird Conservancy of the Rockies to work with Russell and his family to say, look, we don't need you to change anything that you're doing on this ranch. Whatever you're doing right. We want to learn from you. But boy, the notion of protecting prairie dogs, I mean, he was ostracized in his community. People just stopped talking to him. Other ranchers, at a time of the year when ranchers go around, it's called neighboring. You go
helping each other.
Yeah, helping each other out during branding season where, you know, everybody shows up at the Weininger Davis Ranch to help out with branding there. And then everybody shows up at the Stockton Ranch. And everybody shows up at the next ranch. Well, they stopped inviting him. They just cut him off completely. It was even hard in his family. His brothers, his father thought that he was making a terrible mistake. People kept telling him, you're going to lose the ranch. Well, it was also the start of a journey for Russell. And the more he learned and the more he listened, and the more he observed, he realized that there was a way to ranch in unison, in conjunction, in harmony with the environment. You know, cattle ranching does not have a good reputation in this country, and it's often a justifiedly poor reputation. We've had generations of poor range management and overgrazing. But there are ranchers out there like Russell Davis that are determined to figure out ways to work with the land rather than against the environment. And he's become kind of an evangelist for this. He's now, involved at a national level with an organization called Partnerscapes, which is out there working like landowner to landowner, trying to figure out ways to help landowners of all stripes you know, make a living off their land, but do it in a way that is environmentally sensitive. And the crazy thing is, Russell said, you see what's parked out in my driveway these days? He's driving a Toyota truck.
Well, and I also love that his neighbors and friends that had ostracized him have kind of come around and understand, absolutely, where he's coming from. But it was a long and difficult journey. And kind of related to that, you tell the stories another part of the West where there are sage grouse, which are very, very interesting, cool birds. And I think there was a saying, if I'm getting this right, what's good for the bird is good for the herd.
That's right. Yep.
Where that same kind of mentality of like, no, we can be ranching and having these cattle and yet have it work for both us and nature. Because when it really comes down to it, ranchers, people that live in the West and love cattle, they don't want to live in a city environment. They want to live in a place that's natural.
And one of the points, I had a long conversation with a fellow named Seth Gallagher, who works for the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, which is this huge sort of quasi-public, quasi-private entity that funds a lot of the conservation work that goes on in the United States. And Seth made the point that grassland birds are the group of birds that are in the deepest trouble in North America, and particularly across the short grass prairies of the West. The use of the land that is going to provide security for those grassland birds by a long measure is grazing. Now it needs to be grazing that's done right. It can't be, you can't overstock the range. You can't beat it to death. I spent time with a guy named Grady Grissom who learned that lesson the hard way. Grady grew up on ranches on his grandparents' ranches in Nebraska and Colorado. And after he graduated from college with a graduate degree in geology, went into business with his Princeton roommate, who is a hedge fund manager. They bought a huge ranch in southeastern Colorado, and Grady started managing it the way generations of ranchers have managed that land. And he almost bankrupted them because the land just could not support that sort of extractive approach to ranching. And so Grady started working with the Bird Conservancy of the Rockies, and a superb group based out in Fort Collins, and said, okay, what can I do to bring this land back to full health? And it's funny, he's not a birder. I spent time with Grady. He can't tell one bird from another. But he is aware of how the bird abundance and diversity on Rancho Largo has increased over the years. And he's done it by focusing his attention on the grass, on increasing the diversity of native grasses on that land, fine-tuning the way his cattle are moved across that range in ways that mimic the way bison would have grazed years ago, like coming into an area and hitting it really hard and then not touching it again for 2 years, moving the cattle off that section and letting that range recover. Now, are Russell and Grady typical of ranchers in this country? No, unfortunately, they're not. But they are showing a way forward for a grazing economy that can produce meat at reasonable levels in ways that are balanced with the environment.
And it was also interesting to me in that same part of that story that the encroachment of conifers, of trees,
right,
has adversely affected the bird populations,
right,
the sage, those sage lands. Right. And that was interesting to me, sure, that, getting rid of those can be a huge help for the landscape. Right.
Exactly. And so, with the sage grouse, it's just to circle back to them, they're the largest grouse in North America. These things are enormous. The males can weigh up to 7 pounds. And they live on the sagebrush steppe. So, it's particularly in places like the Great Basin, where you had these enormous areas of sagebrush. And that sagebrush steppe was maintained through history by, I think, the intelligent application of fire by indigenous peoples across the West, the Shoshone, the Paiute, the Bannock, at low levels and
low intensity burns
and long recovery periods. The problem is that since settlement, for one thing, we don't like fire. So as soon as a fire starts, it's put out immediately. Non-native grasses like Medusa head and cheat have come in that are highly flammable. They're annual grasses that cover the landscape during the growing season and then turn tinder dry, and they provide, you know, if a spark hits them, you can have these enormous high-intensity fires that cover hundreds of thousands of acres that destroy the sage. And so, you know, the sage grouse, their numbers have been in decline for a long, long time. The more insidious threat are conifers, because those low-intensity fires also would kill the seedlings of pinyon pine and many different species of western junipers. And with the fire suppression, you had what some people refer to as a green glacier. As conifers began
slowly creeping across the landscape.
Exactly. And sage grouse do not like trees. It's really astonishing how few trees it takes for the landscape to no longer support sage grouse. As little as one or two per acre is enough for a sage grouse to say, I'm out of here, because trees are where predators sit. Trees are where, you know, trees are alien to sage grouse. And with time, you've had, you know, millions and really tens of millions of acres across the West that transitioned from open sagebrush steppe to closed canopy pinyon and juniper forests, and the sage grouse get squeezed out of there.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our interview with bird expert and author Scott Wiedensahl. Scott is a Pulitzer finalist and New York Times bestseller, and we're talking about his newest book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. And thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now with our conversation about bird conservation around the world with Scott Wiedensahl, author of the new book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher. One of the great things about this book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher, is you go all over the world hunting down these interesting stories. And speaking of hunting, let's talk about England and the raptors there, because I was kind of shocked to find out about there are people that, you know, they have hunting reserves there and they don't like those raptors being around.
Yeah, that's right. And as you know, this as somebody who is, I've been a hunter all my life, and that's just the idea of shooting a raptor. I no sooner
it
do that.
It makes me cringe.
Yeah, I no sooner do that than shoot my grandmother. And we're talking here mostly about the north of England and parts of Scotland, where you have these really huge estates, 20, 30,000 acre estates. And the prime game bird on those estates are red grouse, which are related to our willow ptarmigan. They're a separate species. And you have the very British tradition of what are known as driven grouse hunts, where, and this is something that is very elite, very exclusive, extremely expensive. It costs, in some cases, tens of thousands of pounds to sign up for one of these hunts. And so there's, you know, you're dressed in the tweed uniform and the outfit, and the whole thing is mixed up with ritual. The grouse season opens on the 12th of August, the glorious 12th as it's known. And so the grouse are a wild bird, but they are as much a crop on these estates as a field of wheat would be. They're coddled, they're fed, there's medicated grit put out there because they tend, you know, to treat them against a parasitic infection that they sometimes get. And the idea is to produce hundreds to thousands of grouse on these enormous estates so that they can be shot by the hundreds or thousands over the course of a day. So anything that eats those grouse is looked at with a very jaundiced eye. And a lot of these estates practice legal predator control. Foxes, stoats, weasels, crows, ravens can be killed with impunity. Birds of prey under British law cannot, but that does not stop them, unfortunately. And the bird that they hate the most is a bird called the hen harrier.
The harrier, yes.
Very, very similar to the northern harriers that we have in North America. In fact, until recently, they were lumped together as the same species. And the hen harriers breed on these moors, on these heather moors, where the grouse live. And look, they will sometimes take young grouse. There's no question about that. I would argue that they have every right to do that, but the estate owners don't think so. And so these birds are persecuted, and raptors in general. I mean, across, you get, harriers probably get the worst of it, but they also shoot golden eagles and common buzzards and goshawks. And I mean, you know, pretty much any raptor that shows up on one of these estates, there's a very good chance that the gamekeepers are going to shoot them. There's almost never any prosecution for this, even when the people, when it's very obvious who's been doing the shooting. But that does not stop groups like the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, the RSPB, from doing their level best to protect them. And the they're putting satellite transmitters on these birds, and it's hard. I spent time with a fellow named Steve Downing, who spent his life in law enforcement, much of it doing wildlife law enforcement for the West Yorkshire Police Department, now works with the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. And he goes out every summer and finds these harrier nests and fits the young harriers with satellite transmitters so that their movements and their fates can be tracked. And he knows that the chances of a young male harrier making it to his first birthday is about 14%, only about 30% for female harriers. Almost all of them die. And so what Steve does is he names these birds when he puts these transmitters on. He names them for deities from around the world and through history, figuring they need all the divine protection they can get.
Let's go to back across the pond, mm-hmm. And let's talk about the title of your book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher. Oyster catchers and plovers. There was part of your book that kind of cracked me up where you said, I am not a beach person, especially in summer. And oh, yeah. I never really thought about it because I'm a West Coaster, and the beaches I tend to go to and have gone to are not crowded like they are on the East Coast.
Yeah.
So I can understand how you wouldn't want to be around a beach in summer. But briefly tell us about the challenges of managing those shorebird populations in places where people just really want to over-recreate.
Sure. Well, and I think to start, it's important to understand that as a group, shorebirds are doing really, really poorly. Particularly the shorebirds that migrate through the Atlantic Flyway, birds like lesser yellowlegs and semi-palmated sandpipers. Their numbers have been in decline for years, and those declines appear to be accelerating. But again, there are good news stories out there, and there's examples of how you can turn things around. And American oyster catchers are a good example of that. So American oyster catchers are found on the Atlantic coast and the Gulf coast. American black oyster catchers on the West Coast, different species. American oyster catcher populations in the East had declined dramatically during the market hunting period in the 19th century. They started to recover in the early 20th century. And then after World War II, when leisure time kind of kicked in and a lot of what has become kind of American beach culture kicked in, their numbers started going back down again because they were getting crowded off the beaches. You know, American oyster catchers and piping plovers, which are the other species I write about in that chapter, these birds nest on the beach, and they need to be able to move their chicks safely across the beach, back and forth many times a day from the water to from the water's edge and back up into the above the intertidal zone and back into the Back Bay area. And on a lot of beaches in the East, you can drive on the beach. And in fact, places like Plymouth Long Beach in Plymouth, Massachusetts, around Plymouth Harbor, where the Mayflower had first come in all those years ago, there'd be 1,000, 2,000 vehicles on the beach on a day. You can imagine a tiny little newborn shorebird or a nest sitting in the sand has absolutely no chance under those circumstances. Well, with time, the piping plovers were listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act, and it no longer became possible for people to drive willy-nilly on the beaches. Protections came in for them. Now, oyster catchers were never listed, so their numbers continued to fall even through the 1980s and 90s and early 2000s as piping plovers numbers rose year after year after year. And there were two main problems. One was disturbance. They were just, birds were just getting crowded off the beach. But also it was nest predation. A lot of these nests were being destroyed. A lot of the chicks were being killed and eaten by predators that were attracted to the beach by the stuff that people leave behind. Foxes, coyotes, raccoons, crows. And in about 2008, a group of scientists working on an American oyster catcher working group, and they said, you know, if we don't do anything, the trends tell us in the next 10 years, we're going to lose another 12% of our American oyster catchers. But if we could increase oyster catcher productivity by, on average, half a chick per nest per year, that would be enough to go from not a 12% decrease, but a 30% increase in the oyster catcher population. And by implementing, again, some fairly simple things, nest protection, some predator control on the beach, especially keeping things like feral cats and off-leash dogs away, they were able to do that. And in fact, we've seen a 45% increase in oyster catcher populations since 2008, at a time when I said when most other shorebird numbers are still in steep decline. Now, oyster catchers and piping plovers have some advantages. They winter mostly in North America. They're not migrating long distances to South America, so they don't have those long, dangerous migrations. But it shows what's possible if we do the science and apply ourselves to figuring out how to solve the problems that science tells us these birds are facing.
Scott, there are so many amazing conservation stories and triumphs and trials in this epic book that you've written. We've only gotten to a fraction of them, but we're about out of time. Before we let you go, after you've completed this project and written this wonderful book, tell us about your hopes for the future for our birds.
You know, I think I keep going back to something I said earlier. I teach every summer at Audubon's Hog Island Camp on the coast of Maine. And one of the great things I get to do during our summer field ornithology sessions, I'm there with a group of teen ornithology students. And I was out last summer with them. We were out on Muscungus Bay in a boat. And look, these are intelligent young, you know, older teens who are connected to the natural world. They're avid birders. They're young conservationists. They know what the score is. They understand all the challenges that we're up against here. And we were having a conversation about the impact of climate change on the Gulf of Maine and on breeding birds like Atlantic puffins, that they were going to go out and visit one of the restored puffin colonies on the coast of Maine the next day. And they were bummed. They're like, you know, they recognize that the migrations that they're seeing in the spring are kind of an echo of what I saw when I was younger. And I said, look, I know that somebody your age hates it when somebody my age says, when I was your age. But, you know, mm-hmm. I said, how many bald eagles have we seen today? And they were like, oh, you know, somebody pulled up his eBird checklist and said, oh, we've seen 22. I said, yeah. So when I was 17, the notion of seeing 22 bald eagles in a morning was incomprehensible. I mean, the annual migration at Hawk Mountain that fall was 18. You know, I said, my hope is that when you're my age and you're talking to somebody who's your age now, you'll say, look, I know this seems incomprehensible to you, but when I was your age, we thought we were going to lose all this. And look what we've done. We've figured out a way to recreate a sustainable, robust, rich, vibrant natural world. And we've brought back those bird populations, you know, and we have to, you know, Dave, we don't have a choice but to figure this out. Our survival hinges on this. And birds are the best indicator of how we're doing. So do I get discouraged when I open up, turn on my computer in the morning and read the news? God, yes, I get discouraged. I see how, you know, we as a nation have done a complete about face and are marching in the other direction. But I also have seen how all around the world, in places that are not the United States, people recognize what needs to be done and are doing the work. You know, we didn't get into, you know, the rewilding movement in Europe and the fact that, like, despite the war in Ukraine, there are conservationists in Ukraine working in the Danube River Delta, the largest wetland area in Europe, on bird conservation, despite the fact that, you know, you can hear the air raid sirens wailing at night. People are stepping up and doing the work. And that gives me optimism at a time when I think we need it more than anything else.
Scott Weidensahl, it's been a joy to talk to you about this great book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet. Thanks for writing this, and thanks for all you've done for wild birds, you know, throughout your career.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Dave. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed this conversation enormously.
Thanks again to our guest, author and bird enthusiast, Scott Weidensahl. You can get his latest book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher, at most major booksellers or at your favorite local bookstore. I'd also like to dedicate this program to my late friend and colleague, Cornyn Union High School science teacher, David Tinker. Dave was beloved by his family, community, and his students in particular. Dave's deep love of birds was one of his life's driving passions. Godspeed, Tinker the Birdman, you left us far too soon. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler, with production assistance from Chico State student Madeline Cortez. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.